The headlines this hour. War of words escalate between Russia and Israel. Moscow says Israeli mercenaries are fighting alongside far-right militants in Ukraine. The European Union outlines a gradual ban on Russian oil imports over its war in Ukraine. And Iranian health officials report single-digit COVID-related deaths for the first time in over 2 years. Well, welcome to the studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Russia and Israel are engaged in a row over Ukraine. The Russian Foreign Ministry spokeswoman says Israeli mercenaries are fighting alongside far-right anti-Moscow militants in Ukraine. Maria Zakharova said Israel is certainly aware of teaming up with the militants of the Azov Regiment that Russia views as fascists and Nazis. On Tuesday, the Russian Foreign Ministry also accused Tel Aviv of backing what it called the neo-Nazi regime in Kyiv. The war of words between the two sides started on Sunday, after the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Adolf Hitler had Jewish blood. His remarks drew fierce backlash in Israel. The regime has expressed solidarity with Ukraine over an ongoing Russian military operation there. The European Union has unveiled plans for a gradual ban on Russian oil imports as part of its sixth round of sanctions against Russia over its war in Ukraine.
Today, we are addressing our dependency on Russian oil. And let's be clear, it will not be easy, because some member states are strongly dependent on Russian oil, but we simply have to do it. So today we will propose to ban all Russian oil from Europe. This will be a complete import ban on all Russian oil, seaborne and pipeline, crude and refined.
Von der Leyen said the sanctions also include removing Russia's biggest bank from the international SWIFT payment system. Plus, the package blacklists military figures and the head of the Russian Orthodox Church. However, gas exports are excluded from the embargo. If approved, the oil ban will be implemented gradually over the course of a year in order to allow countries to adapt to the situation. This has drawn reactions from some bloc members, such as Hungary and Germany, that remain heavily dependent on Russian oil and gas imports.
The transition period is long enough for us to take all the necessary precautions to create alternatives for Russian oil in Germany. Taking precautions does not mean that they will be realized immediately. I have said a few times that we can, of course, not guarantee in this situation that there won't be disruptions, primarily regional disruptions.
But the German economy minister backed the measure, calling it a necessary step. Hungary, however, has said that it wants to be exempted, arguing the ban on Russian oil would destroy the country's energy security. Hungary's foreign minister said that Budapest would not vote in favor of the EU sanctions package in its current form. Representatives of the 27-member bloc met to discuss the plan, which needs unanimous approval. They will meet again on Thursday, as they failed to reach a consensus today. We talked to our correspondent in Brussels, Jerome Hughes, to get more details about the EU's new sanctions on Russia.
That this is the sixth round of sanctions being proposed by the European Commission. And as you mentioned, you know, it's a proposal from the European Commission. They formulate the sanctions, and then it's up to the European Council to basically agree on it. That's the 27 member states, the EU leaders. And of course, it has to be rubber stamped finally in the European Parliament. But there are divisions, and that's because, you know, the repercussions, as you mentioned, we heard statements like, you know, the EU doesn't want to shoot itself in the foot during this debate in the European Parliament. But in terms of the sanctions itself, von der Leyen outlined more individuals will be placed on the EU sanction list, more Russian individuals, mainly involved in Russia's military. There's a proposal to take Russia's largest bank out of the SWIFT financial transfer payment system, which is a significant move from a financial perspective. A number of media organizations, more media, Russian media organizations, are being banned from EU airwaves. But the big one is the complete ban on the import of Russian oil between now and the end of the year. And no mention specifically of gas, of course. The big questions, some of the questions being asked in the European Parliament today is how might Russia respond? because, of course, we do import a lot of oil from Russia, but the big one is the gas. And therefore, if there is if Russia decides, for example, to disrupt the supply of gas to more EU countries, like we saw in Poland and Bulgaria, what could be the financial implications for the European Union? So a lot of questions like that. Also, lawmakers were asking the questions, do sanctions work? I mean, don't forget, we're talking about six rounds of sanctions now, but I mean, the EU has been applying sanctions on Russia since 2014. And many lawmakers are saying that the sanctions don't work, that sanctions do not work because, you know, the EU is it's not the case that it's the only show in town for Russia. Russia can also do business with many other countries and so on. Therefore, the effectiveness of the sanctions is being called into question.
Russia says its forces have disabled six railway stations in Ukraine that were used to transfer troops and foreign weapons to the flashpoint to eastern Donbas region. The Defense Ministry spokesman said high-precision air and seaborne weapons were used to destroy the railway stations in five Ukrainian regions. Igor Konashenkov added that Russian forces also hit 40 more Ukrainian military targets, including four arms and ammunition depots. Earlier, Ukraine's Defense Ministry said Russia is attempting to intensify its offensive in the east. Russia launched a war on Ukraine late in February in order to, quote, demilitarize and denazify the country. Since then, Ukraine's Western allies, and U.S. in particular, have hit Moscow with a wave of sanctions. Moscow has also responded to those measures in kind. Iran registers single-digit COVID-related deaths for the first time in over 2 years. The health ministry has reported seven fatalities and over 250 cases from the virus in the past 24 hours. The total number of deaths in the country stands at over 140,000. More than 7 million people have been infected since the start of the pandemic. In January, Iran experienced a surge in cases and deaths, largely due to the highly transmissible Omicron variant of the strain. The government used an extensive vaccination campaign to curb its spread. So far, more than 68% of the population has received the second dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. The Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has warned Israel against allowing flocks of settlers to storm Al-Aqsa Mosque. Hamas said Israel would be held accountable as it is playing with fire and dragging the region into an escalation. The group urged Palestinians to stop settlers from any act of aggression and vandalism at Al-Aqsa on Thursday. It also denounced the regime for its move to prevent the evening call to prayer at Al-Aqsa, calling it the violation of the sanctity of Islam's third holiest site. Hamas' warning comes after some right-wing Israeli groups called on settlers to ascend to the mosque compound. In recent weeks, the regime has intensified its violent attacks on Palestinians across the West Bank, including Muslim worshippers at Al-Aqsa in Al-Quds. Administrative detention is an illegal practice that Israel uses extensively and routinely to hold Palestinians. Incarceration has no time limit, and the charges, if any, are never disclosed. The number of Palestinians held under this measure has hit a record high since 2016, but the international community is keeping silent on administrative detention, as it does with other apartheid practices of the Tel Aviv regime. And this is seen as a green light for Israel to continue its illegal occupation and violation of Palestinians' rights.
An Israeli rights group has shed light on the regime's brutal behavior towards Palestinians. According to Hamoked, Israel is holding 604 detainees without charge or trial. Nearly all the detainees are Palestinian. The Israeli regime rarely uses administrative detention against Jews. The last time Israel held this many administrative detainees was in October 2016. Back then, the regime's illegal settlement expansion plan sparked a wave of anger and frustration amongst Palestinians. Administrative detainees are arrested on, quote, secret evidence. They are unaware of the accusations against them and are not allowed to defend themselves in court. The detainees are usually held for renewable 6-month periods that often lead to years in detention. Israel claims the procedure allows authorities to hold suspects while continuing to gather evidence. But critics and rights groups say the system is widely abused and denies due process. Several Palestinians in administrative detention have gone on prolonged hunger strikes in protest, while many developing lifelong health issues. Administrative detainees and their lawyers have boycotted Israeli military court proceedings since the start of this year in protest, and the courts are holding hearings without them. Some prisoners have been held in administrative detention for up to 11 years.
Currently, more than 2,400 Palestinians are serving sentences after being convicted in Israeli military courts, and close to 1,500 others are being held for questioning, awaiting trial or being tried. In the meantime, Israel has detained more than 9,000 Palestinian children across the occupied territories over the past 7 years.
According to Israeli rights groups, 2,441 Palestinians are currently serving sentences after being convicted in Israel's military courts. A further 1,478 detainees are being held for questioning, have been charged and are awaiting trial, or are currently being tried. Last month, the Palestinian Prisoners Society, or the PPS, said the Israeli regime has detained more than 9,000 Palestinian children across the occupied territories over the past 7 years. Palestinian authorities say 1,500 Palestinian children were killed by Israeli forces during the time span beginning at the outbreak of the Second Intifada in September 2000 up to April 2013. That's the equivalent of one Palestinian child killed every 3 days for about 13 years.
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that's quite clear is that the so-called, you know, security domination of the Israeli occupation is very fragile. And in reality, the Palestinian resistance is exposing that on a daily basis. But that resistance is also taking place inside the prisons as well. Every single one of these over 600 Palestinians jailed without charge or trial under administrative detention are currently engaged in a collective boycott of the military courts to demand that this illegal system, an illegitimate system, come to an immediate end.
The Palestinian Prisoners Center for Studies, or the PCBS, said in a report in September last year that Israeli authorities had clearly escalated targeting Palestinian children. Systematic torture, harassment, and repression are all examples of the fashion in which the Israeli prison authorities treat Palestinian prisoners. The Israeli prison service keeps the prisoners under deplorable conditions, lacking proper hygienic standards. Human rights organizations say Israel violates all the rights and freedoms granted to prisoners by the Geneva Convention. Israel has for years held Palestinians in overcrowded prisons with poor hygiene standards.
Yemen says its air defenses have shot down a Saudi spy drone flying over its airspace. According to Yemeni media, the drone was downed after the northwestern city of Hajja. Yemen's military has already brought down dozens of drones operated by the Saudi-led coalition in recent years. The incident comes amid a UN-brokered ceasefire agreement reached between the warring sides on April the 1st. Yemen says the coalition has, on multiple occasions, violated the truce by launching attacks. The U.S. Navy says it has allowed over 200 sailors to leave the USS George Washington aircraft carrier after multiple deaths by suicide among the crew. The sailors were moved to a naval facility while the aircraft carrier was on its way to Virginia for refueling and overhaul process. The move followed reported suicides on board, including three in April alone. It has prompted the Navy to launch a probe. Last year, the U.S. President announced a new plan to clamp down the risk of suicides among service members and veterans. The plan included a focus on improving safety by limiting their access to objects that could be used to cause self-harm. Pentagon statistics show that 19 out of every 100,000 sailors died by suicide in 2020. The U.S. Army had the highest suicide rate at about 36 per 100,000 the same year. North Korea has test-launched yet another ballistic missile amid worries on the Korean Peninsula over its nuclear program. South Korean military says it detected the launch in the Sunan area of Pyongyang. It says the missile flew for about 470 kilometers toward the sea off the north's east coast. comes a week after the North Korean leader vowed to accelerate the development of his country's nuclear arsenal, calling it a symbol of national power. Kim Jong-un also said that the North would not shy away from the preemptive use of nuclear weapons to counter hostile forces. This year alone, North Korea has fired 14 short- and long-range ballistic missiles. The country has doubled down on Kim's military modernization drive, as well as missile tests, while ignoring the offer of talks from the U.S. Our Seoul correspondent Jennifer Chang joined us earlier with details about North Korea's missile and nuclear programs.
We have to see what kind of missile this is, and those results of the investigation will come out later. However, just last week, the North paraded its Hwasong-17 monster ICBM, which the U.S. missile defenses are helpless to stop. This missile can hit any point in the U.S. with a nuclear warhead. And so this is going to be what the focal point will be. The North had fired a missile, an ICBM missile, which it said was the Hwasong-17 last month, but the U.S. and South Korea claimed that this was not the Hwasong-17, but the Hwasong-15, an earlier version. And Pyongyang is eager to show that it is indeed firing off the Hwasong-17. Now, the Hwasong-17 is different from the Hwasong-15 because it has multiple warheads and decoys that can evade any U.S. missile defense systems.
The family of an Iranian national on trial in Sweden for alleged rights abuses say that Hamid Nouri, a retired employee of the Iranian judiciary, was humiliated, beaten, and denied access to medical services. Swedish prosecutors have requested life imprisonment for Nouri over alleged human rights violations against members of the anti-Iran terror group Mujahideen Khalq organization back in the 1980s. Videos on social media show MKO members harassing Nouri's family as they enter a court building. Footage shows the Swedish police failed to protect the family. Meanwhile, Nouri's wife laments that Swedish officials did not allow them to even meet him for nearly 2 years after his arrest. On Sunday, Iran's foreign ministry summoned the Swedish ambassador to protest the detention and trial of Nouri. The ministry said it considers Nouri's detention illegal and based on propaganda by the anti-Iran terror group MKO. The ministry rejected allegations against Nouri as baseless and described his trial as political show. The MKO is responsible for killing some 12,000 Iranian people and officials in the 1980s, including the country's then president and prime minister. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. Limelight.
Without conditionality on human rights or a mechanism for accountability, how can an enhanced trading relationship be understood by the Israeli regime as anything other than support for its violations and war crimes? Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Sarah Hosseini and Mazen Masri Writers. This article is published under the heading, UK Trade Deal with Israeli Regime Sends a Clear Message. Apartheid is rewarded. Here's the story. The UK's Department for International Trade is currently considering public submissions ahead of negotiations for a new free trade agreement, FTA, with the fabricated regime of Israel. In a joint piece for The Telegraph in November, UK Foreign Secretary Liz Truss came together with the Zionist regime's foreign minister Yair Lapid to celebrate the prospect of transforming a close relationship into an even closer partnership through a new strategic plan for the next decade, spanning cyber, tech, trade and so-called defense. On March 29th, UK chief negotiator for the agreement, James Clark, appealed directly to readers of the London-based Jewish Chronicle to help shape discussions ahead of a new bilateral trade agreement. Both of these pieces provide a telling indication of how the British government intends to negotiate this trade deal, namely without consideration of the broader political and human rights context and without factoring in or actively consulting with all of the communities who stand to be affected by this deal, most notably Palestinians, whether in Palestine or in the UK. The British government's promotion of an enhanced trade deal is perhaps unsurprising. The current UK-Israeli regime relationship is worth almost £5 billion, and yet the deepening ties with the fabricated regime of Israel, while it continues to impose its system of control over the Palestinians and persistently violates international law, is not only morally and legally questionable, but short-sighted. The Zionist regime's violations of international law have been well documented over almost three quarters of a century. Numerous UN resolutions, legal opinions, and international reports confirm the illegality of the Zionist regime's settlements, enterprises, and associated violations, a position at least formally reflected in UK foreign policy. As the Israeli regime routinely announces the expansion of settlements throughout the entirety of the territory between the Mediterranean Sea and Jordan River, it also continues to fully integrate those settlements, including the production and manufacturing industries, financial services, and many other types of business that profit from the expropriation of Palestinian land and resources. A free trade deal would effectively help to maintain this illegal situation. I
An FTA in this context also stands to make British businesses and citizens complicit in human rights abuses, despite commitments made by the British government to the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights through its National Action Plan. It also sends a message to the Zionist regime that not only will the continued killing, maiming, forced expulsions, residency revocations, mass political incarcerations, and denial of rights of Palestinians be tolerated by the UK, but materially rewarded. A prospective FTA is only one for a number of ways in which the message is being projected by this British government. Voting against recent UN Human Rights Council resolutions on Palestinian self-determination and Israeli settlements, in stark contrast to the international consensus and opposing the investigation of the International Criminal Court into the Zionist regime war crimes, serve to actively shield the fake regime of Israel from accountability. The continued failure of the British government to challenge the Zionist regime's criminalization of six human rights organizations, condemned by UN experts as a frontal attack not only on Palestinian human rights but on human rights everywhere, and fully at odds with the UK commitment to human rights defenders, provides yet another indication of this position. And the British government has still to show any signs of meaningfully engaging with an ever-growing body of evidence from Palestinian and international human rights organizations, most recently Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the UN Special Rapporteur, that the Zionist regime's laws, policies, and practices meets the legal definition of apartheid. In a post-Brexit era, Britain has an opportunity to be a leader in negotiating diplomatic relationships based on respect for human rights and the rule of law. Continuously failing to hold the fake regime of Israel accountable to universal standards calls into question the British government's own commitment to these principles and its credibility on the international stage, particularly at a time when international law and mechanisms are being invoked in other contexts and trade and diplomacy are being used as tools to promote accountability in other parts of the world. Fundamentally, signing a free trade agreement at this time would send a clear message that continued settlement expansion, annexation, and apartheid are actions to be rewarded rather than to be held to account. Without conditionality on human rights or any other mechanisms for accountability, how can an enhanced trading relationship be understood by the Israeli regime, or indeed any other state actors observing this deal, as anything other than support for legal violations and war crimes? And as the balance of power tips further in favor of the perpetrator of these violations, how can this move achieve anything but take us yet further from a just future for all?
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladheena amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis sabri was salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So dear brothers and sisters in Islam, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Now this year, inshallah, what we're going to be talking about has been called the transition. Today we'll be beginning, inshallah, with the the barzakh. Okay. But before we get into that discussion, we need to ask another fundamental question. Is this really the right topic for now, considering that we are a youth center, meaning the Hadi Institute, we're a youth center? Is this a discussion, the hereafter, Nakir and Munkar, the interrogation, right? Is that a discussion for youth? Or is that a discussion where maybe, let's say, the target audience was older? And, I mean, in our own minds, we think closer to death. Maybe for them that discussion would be good. But for us to be talking about those details and what happens and the grave, is that healthy? Is it good to talk about death, to prepare for death in this way? Is it good for our mental health? Will it lead to depression? We need to cover that. So that'll be our first question. And the answer that I'm going to give three reasons why we should be having this discussion. And of course, there are more reasons than this. I'm going to share three reasons why it's important for us to have these discussions. So what are those three reasons why it's good for us to be having these discussions right now? The first of them is this. For us as Muslims, as believers, we say, remembering the hereafter, the place where we're going, the next life, it actually helps us live better here. Because Islam came for both, this world and the next. It gives us instructions for both, this world and the next. It tells us everything from how to run our political affairs, to how to raise our children, to how to interact with other people, our social lives, our economic lives, and it also gives us guidance for the hereafter. But if we take the guidance found in Quran and Sunnah, we actually end up enjoying and benefiting from this opportunity that you and I have here, and then after that we experience Allah's best in the hereafter. I'll give you one example of this. In Islam, brothers and sisters, the path of the Ahlul Bayt, because that's what we're studying, the path of the Ahlul Bayt, what have they taught us? One of the things that you see they've repeated, and you've heard this from me, you've heard this from other scholars, you've seen repeated in the teachings of Quran and Sunnah, is that Islam is not against the idea of you having this world, having the dunya. That the problem is, in Islam, we want to see you living in a cave, a recluse, wearing ripped clothes off in the mountains. No. In Islam, we actually enjoy life in this world. We have possessions here. It's recommended for us to improve the lives of our children, our wives and our children. Let's say I'm a man and I'm working. One of the reasons to work is that it's good for me to improve their life standard. That's a good thing. There's nothing wrong with that. What's the problem, though? One of the problems is the attachment to the dunya. That's the issue. I think this world is mine. These are my things. And then when I'm faced with the test, because you and I, we know this, in Islam, God never promises that because you are a good Muslim, because you did all the right things, you are always kind, then you don't get tested. No, you will get tested. When I am tested, and then Allah takes me away from those things in the dunya, because it happens to everybody, how do I feel? So let me repeat that. Does it mean we don't have, we're not emotionally attached to our wife and children, to our babies, to our spouses? We're not emotionally, no, we are. Actually, we love our children. I mean, if you look in Karbala, the connection between the Imam and his ashab before they went, right? But at the same time, when I will depart this dunya, do I have that negative connection to it? Holding on, this is mine. The kind of connection to this world that takes me away from Allah. So instead of me being ready for the Imam of the time and ready to drop everything when the Imam returns, I'm slowed down by my possessions. Islam gave me the best of the life in this world and the next, but now the same blessings have turned into a nightmare. Because of my blessings, I can't let go. I can't do my responsibility.
So the danger, brothers and sisters, is not having this world, but being attached to it. Not being able to spend. How can I spend in the way of Allah? Because it's mine. I'm losing. But another time you take the Islamic, this is Allah's. This is an amana. Allah says spend his wealth in this way. Why not? I'm not attached. So one of the benefits of the discussion of the hereafter is we don't get so attached to the dunya. And that's what's negative. So I want to give you an example of this. This is from the life of Imam Al-Kadhim, alayhi salam. Now what happens is everything about the Ahlul Bayt is a lesson. There's wisdom in every step that they take, everything that they say. Imam Al-Kadhim was standing somewhere and the Muslims were burying an individual. They were bringing the dead body. And the imam is by the grave. They go over, they perform the rituals, and they're leaving. And then the imam says something very thoughtful. Listen to the words of the imam. He says, "Inna shay'an hadha akhiruhu lahaqiqun an yuzhada fi awwalihi." Anything where it ends up like this, people carrying me, I don't have my money, my wealth, my children. I mean, if you look at a graveyard, a funeral procession, the people's family, and they cry, but eventually they leave, they go. So I don't have my wealth. It's just me. I'm wrapped in that kafan, that burial shroud, and they put me in a hole, and then they go. The imam says, anything that ends like this, he said, nobody should be attached to it from the very beginning. If the dunya, if the story of the dunya, you build this castle, you run this, own this company, you do this, I built this many houses, this many degrees, and in the end, all you have is the cloth they wrap you in, and then you're buried. And they leave you to your own devices. He said, something where the end is this. He said, it doesn't make sense to get attached to it, that negative attachment. Then he says something else, though. He says, but when there's something where it begins like this, if the journey to the hereafter, the qabr, the grave, it begins like this, he says, لَحَقِيقٌ أَن يُخَافَ آخِرُ. He says that anything that begins like this, you really need to be afraid with how it ends. How do we prepare for something like this? It begins like this. So that's the first reason why we should be having these discussions. I actually enjoy the blessings of Allah more when I'm not attached.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi. كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صل عليه.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales.
Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
This isn't just some corporate takeover, said one critic, adding, this is about a set of very specific moves that oligarchs have been taking that have gradually concentrated economic, political, and discursive power in fewer and fewer hands. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, A Real Threat to Democracy. Musk buys Twitter for $44 billion. Here's the details. April 25, 2022, rights advocates, public health experts, and media critics were among those who warned that the purchase of Twitter by mega-billionaire Elon Musk, the world's richest person, creates a direct threat to democracy and the common good by putting the outsized power of the social media platform used by hundreds of millions worldwide into the hands of one man. The social media company accepted Musk's offer to purchase Twitter for $44 billion, or $54.20 per share, leading some critics to note other ways the enormous sum of money could have been spent rather than on what Representative Chai Garcia called a vanity project boondoggle to silence Musk's critics. Tax the rich, Garcia said on Twitter. Musk's purchase has led to concern that former President Donald Trump's Twitter account will be reinstated. Trump was banned from the platform in January 2021 after violating its rules by inciting his followers to violently attack the U.S. Capitol in an effort to stop the certification of the 2020 presidential election results. Musk hasn't just purchased another expensive Play Toy, but a global online community that includes about 330 million regular users, said Jessica Gonzalez, co-CEO of Free Press, adding, with control of such a massive platform comes great responsibility, and Musk hasn't shown he has the capacity to be accountable to this diverse online community. She added, noting Musk's own history of using Twitter to intimidate and disparage others, including journalists, elected officials, owners of competing businesses, and anyone else who might challenge his views. With Musk at the helm, Gonzalez said, Twitter must improve its content moderation practices and stop amplifying bigotry and conspiracy theories that pollute public discourse, threaten the health and safety of users, and undermine democracy. Musk has criticized Twitter's efforts to moderate the platform, saying early this month that he believes it's just really important that people have the reality and the perception that they are able to speak freely within the bounds of the law, and that the civilizational risk is decreased the more we can increase the trust of Twitter as a public platform. Journalist Anand Giridharadas said that by taking over Twitter and claiming he will protect the platform, as the digital town square where matters vital to the future of humanity are debated, Musk is doing is what plutocrats have been doing, branding themselves the solution to the very problem they are. This isn't just some corporate takeover, he said, adding, this is about a set of very specific moves that oligarchs have been taking that have gradually concentrated economic, political, and discursive power in fewer and fewer hands. As Media Matters reported recently, right-wing politicians in the U.S. have been in favor of Musk's purchase since he first offered to buy the platform earlier this month. Representative Jim Jordan led 18 House Republicans in writing to Twitter's board of directors demanding that the board preserve all records related to Musk's bid. The right's propagandist had celebrated Musk's bid as a way to garner political gain by ending the company's purported political censorship, reported senior fellow Matt Gaetz, adding, then its elected GOP champions, responding to hesitation from and when Twitter's board raised the prospect of a costly congressional investigation if his offer wasn't accepted. While Twitter was a large and powerful company before Musk's takeover was announced, said Sana Said of Al Jazeera, the purchase does underscore an unnerving trend. The ability of a single man to purchase something that impacts hundreds of millions beyond users in order to influence it in its own image. It's less than great when billionaires own sports teams, which bind communities together as their playthings, said Robert Weisman, president of consumer advocacy group Public Citizen, adding, having a billionaire own Twitter, a vital platform for communication and community, as his plaything is far more serious. It's a real threat to democracy.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1930 to 2030 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered on April 12, 2022 by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the government officials of the Islamic Republic.
What does piety mean? It means taking complete care of oneself. Piety, which is commonly defined as fear of God, means this. Fear of God has such a meaning. It means taking care not to take action against God's commands. This is piety in such cases when the Quran says, But if you are constant and do right, there is a specific quality which is piety against the enemy. This means watching over the enemy and his moves. Watching our own moves against him, being careful about his maneuvers and activities and about our response which might originate from negligence. Piety means this. The commander of the faithful says, the warrior should be wakeful because if he sleeps, the enemy does not sleep. This is in Nahjul Balagha, the Peak of the Eloquence, letter 62. This means being awake and remaining focused. In this era, piety means this. It contains the same general meaning of piety, but here it shows itself by watching over the enemy. This holds true in all areas.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In diplomacy, economy, security, piety is necessary. It is necessary in all these areas. In various matters, piety is necessary in line with the requirements of that matter. We must ask God for His help and take complete care of things. This was about God's command. Our experience shows the same thing too. Once we used to read these Quranic ayahs and verses, and the only experience we had was history, and we used to cite the early Islamic era as an experience. But today, this is not the case anymore. Today, we ourselves have experienced these matters. We ourselves have experienced in different arenas that if we show patience and piety, we will be victorious. The day when the war broke out, I am speaking about the sacred defense era, many of us would think that the war would last a week, 10 or 20 days, but it lasted 8 years. From the first day, Imam Rahmatullah Alayhi was confident. He did not announce that we would win, but we did not see any anxiety in him. He would ask questions, wanted explanations, and ask for details in meetings with the presence of officials. He would ask about things and why such and such thing was done, but there was no sign of worry and anxiety in Imam's face and behavior. In other words, he felt assured that it would end well, and he stood firm. He stood firm on various matters.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
In this journey, IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.